And I'm Danny Schechter. I'm your news dissector. I'm here every week at this time on PRN-FM. Our toll-free number here is 888-874-4888. I'm here with Cat Waters. One more week, we're going to be talking about a movement that's still very much alive with us, the Occupy movement, in the first half hour, and have a big treat for you, the first PRN preview of the new Radio OS, which is a new radio show done by a work group as part of Occupy Wall Street. It's been on the Sprouts program on Pacifica Radio, but not on WBAI. And you'll be able to hear it here in a few moments, produced by Polarity One, but with a whole group of people who are occupiers involved in making the show. The media has covered Occupy, but now Occupy feels it needs its own media to bring its message to the people, and it's doing so. So we're going to hear about that in the second half hour. We're going to be talking about what's happening in Russia, where there's a Occupy the Kremlin movement that's underway, and there's been a lot of activism there. We'll speak to a leading analyst of Russian affairs. We'll speak also, you'll hear from a Russian activist himself, and we'll talk some more about all of that. As for Occupy, Kat, you've been down at 60 Wall Street. What's the latest there?
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on. People are starting to move their meetings back to Zuccotti Park. I heard a discussion, you know, because they've been at 60 Wall Street, and most of the people, like the public, is not aware of 60 Wall Street. They know to go to Zuccotti Park, and so they're talking about bringing a lot of the activities and meetings back to the park.
I guess a lot of that depends on the weather. There's also a new publication from OWS, which you only picked up one copy of for yourself. But tell us what it is.
Yeah, it's called Tidal. This is the second copy, issue number two, Occupy Theory, Occupy Strategy. There's a really good article that I was reading on the subway last night about demands, because there's so much talking about demands and why doesn't Occupy have demands. And just really quickly, if I could just read the second part here that says demands should be capable of being satisfied. This surely seems like a reasonable point, but anyone who argues that demands must be capable of being satisfied assumes that there is someone or some existing institutional power to whom one could appeal to have one's demands satisfied. So that kind of, you know, is like question.
Well, the whole idea here is our system is so broken.
Exactly.
Congress only has something like 7% support, 7 to 10% of the people even support the Congress of the United States. There's tremendous disaffection in the country cutting across all political lines. We see it in the Republican primaries, surely, where the debate has been fierce and the, you know, condemnations of candidates of each other are very intense. Well, the same thing certainly is happening on the left. And in fact, the New York Times ran a picture from inside Obama headquarters this week of people who are mining data. Apparently, the tens of thousands of people who gave small donations to the Obama campaign, many of them are not doing it anymore, don't want to do it, have lost faith, if you will, have lost respect and support for the president. And as a consequence, now the Democrats and the Obama people are trying to find a hook, a way to bring them back in with this data mining operation to find out what they do care about and see if they could target emails at them. So this is a big crisis. And, you know, in a way, the Obama administration is really banking on the continued war within the Republican ranks, because when you look at Obama as compared to some of these GOP candidates, he looks so much better, even if he is open to criticism on what he has and hasn't accomplished, and his whole attitude, contempt, if you will, for progressives and the left. I mean, he's extremely, you know, person who's extremely disengaged with any social movements. He's aloof. He's often arrogant. And, you know, as a consequence, there are many people who would want to support him who are finding problems doing so. So we have both political parties in a situation where their own bases are fragmented. And on top of all of that, we have you know, continuing crisis in the country. This has been the week, I guess, the week to bomb Iran, you know, with the AIPAC meetings in Washington, with all these politicians trying to outdo each other and how extreme they can be on radio and television. And all of them, you know, we would bomb Iran. At the same time, the intelligence agencies, the American intelligence agencies, are saying there's no evidence that Iran is building a bomb. Various people around the world are now talking with the Iranians. There's a process of negotiations. Iran has allowed inspections into their nuclear facility. Yeah.
But didn't you ask the president of Iran directly?
Yeah, well, I asked the president of Iran directly about all this, and his response was, no, we're not building a bomb. And then a week later, the supreme ruler of Iran made a similar statement, a more elaborated statement about their attitude. But it seems to, you know, it's the old story of, you know, the cop who chases the guy he calls a communist, and the guy turns around and says, don't chase me, I'm an anti-communist. And the guy and the cop says, I don't care what kind of communist you are. Okay? So, you know, here's the point. No matter what Iran says, no matter what the intelligence agencies find, if we believe that they have a bomb, then they have the bomb. That's the view of the Israelis, certainly, who are now intensifying their threats, not only demanding bunker buster bombs from the United States, but also threatening to move up the schedule to bomb Iran. So we have, you know, a situation where a war is very imminent. And one of the questions is, would a war with Iran help the Obama campaign? In other words, there are some people feel that if Obama is really down in the polls right before the election, a war might be a way to rally public support, which is really a frightening idea and a totally manipulated idea. Maybe that's why Iran, Obama is basically saying, like, let's stop all this war talk, etc. Meanwhile, the reports are that the Pentagon is preparing more contingencies for military action against Iran. So they're talking peace, they're talking diplomacy, but they're acting for war. And this has been heavily reported. And I think the most intense example of all of this was the AIPAC meeting that took place. There was an Occupy AIPAC protest outside of it. And the question is, you know, is Obama representing the United States or representing Israel? Is Israel the tail that's wagging the dog here? And there's a number of things about this that are worth checking out. The book, The Israel Lobby, has a lot more information about all of this. Rabbi Weiss, who's part of a group of people, of rabbis who support Palestinian rights, and who I met when I was in Iran, you know, has been quoted as saying AIPAC and Israel claim to speak in the name of Judaism, but they are defaming Judaism by waging wars and being oppressive. Jews and Muslims get along. I visit Jewish communities in predominantly Muslim countries, and they can worship freely. What creates all this ill will is that Israel is doing immoral actions in the name of Judaism. This is a Orthodox Jewish rabbi who is saying all of this. So there's a big fight about all of this. I've been writing about it extensively, as I do today, in my blog at newsdissector.net. That's the actual URL of the blog now, newsdissector.net. I suggest you have a look at it, where I'm trying to look at all sides of this thing and also report on the Obama administration. One funny thing last night, I don't know if you saw this, Kat, I don't know if you had watch The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, but last night he claimed to have a secret video which unmasks Sean Hannity of Fox News, you know, because Hannity has just shown a secret video unmasking Obama, which proves that Obama is this radical desperado. You know, they've been calling him a socialist, but now Sean Hannity has come up with proof. And Jon Stewart showed the proof on The Daily Show last night. And I looked at it. I said, wait a minute, that looks familiar. And in fact, that video that Hannity claims is a new revelation that he and Fox News have just found and exposed to the public is actually in my film on Barack Obama, which was made at the very end of the election, 2008. You know, 3 years ago or 4 years ago now. So here you have a situation where claims for exclusive material turn out not to be true. And I write about that as well. I have a whole discussion of various media reports in my blog today, including a URL for Al Jazeera's new film on AIPAC, which I think you'll find very interesting, as well as a discussion of Alona's show on RT, where Alona was talking about Peyton Manning, the quarterback for the Indianapolis Colts, who is being forced to step down partly because the Colts don't want to pay him any more money after years of service to that team and the community. And it was tearful, kind of a parting of the ways, covered by everybody extensively. And Alona said, yeah, that Manning gets a lot of attention, but Bradley Manning, who's a whistleblower being held in prison and being threatened with life imprisonment for revealing war crimes and torture in Iraq, he doesn't get any coverage in the American media. So you have to go to RT, Russia Today, to find that out. In fact, I was on RT last night, and the URL for that is in my blog at newsdissector.net. Okay, that's catching up a little bit on the news and information about what's going on. There's a lot more we could talk about, but I wanted to at least give you that précis. I'm writing about all this. I just also want to mention one other thing, which I think is interesting. About 10 days ago, I was invited to go to speak in Geneva at a UN-related NGO event about the financial crisis and war crimes and crimes against humanity. And I'm going to be giving a talk about this in Geneva on the 13th, just next week. And they're flying me over there. Ramsey Clark will be there as well, a former U.S. Attorney General. So that should be very interesting, and I'll have a full report on that as well. And I'm writing about it, and I'll be blogging about it as well at newsdissector.net. So, but I'll be back in time for next Friday's show, and Glenn Greenwald will be on the program, a writer for Salon who's been doing a lot to really take the U.S. media to the task for its completely distorted coverage of what's happening with Iran and world politics. So that's all coming up here on News Dissector Radio. Now, a little treat, a little surprise, a little something that nobody else has, which is the new Occupy radio show produced by Polarity One. We're going to give you a taste of it here on News Dissector Radio, and maybe if the folks here at PRN like it, they'll also actually showcase this program, because for reasons that escape me, Pacifica Radio is distributing it to its affiliated stations, but not the main Pacifica stations, like here in New York, WBAI. Why it isn't running this program, I have no idea. But let's give it a listen. This is Radio WS.
Radio WS, get occupied.
The next stop is Wall Street.
Everywhere we go!
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Radio WS Actual News, your source of the events that actually affect your lives and the movement. Monday, February 27th, the House and Senate nearly unanimously passed H.R. 347, a bill that widely restricts free speech and makes disruptive political action a felony. Under this bill, heckling politicians in restricted areas will now result in a large fine, a felony on your record, and up to a year in prison. Even more ominous, the bill applies even if you are unaware that the area in question is restricted. If there was any doubt that Congress is working against the rights of Americans to protest in the presence of a legislator, doubt removed. Watch this closely to see if the president vetoes this latest attack on citizens' rights. Tuesday, February 28th, more than 100 million people in India held a nationwide strike, paralyzing the country for a day in a collective effort to push for a national minimum wage, permanent jobs, and a higher standard of living. Wednesday, February 29th, a national day of action. Occupy the corporations. Protests, teach-ins, and community outreach events were held in more than 75 cities to raise awareness of the corruptive influence that the American Legislative Exchange Council has on legislation. For those who don't know, the Council, also known as ALEC, is a coalition of the largest corporations, congressmen, and moneyed special interests who coordinate and devise conservative legislative bills that benefit the rich. No, I am not exaggerating in the slightest. Corporations, among others Monsanto, Walmart, ExxonMobil, and Pfizer, write bills for approval by ALEC. These new bills are taken to Congress and to state assemblies, which adopt them as their own work, sometimes word for word. Of the 1,000 bills submitted by ALEC each year, more than 200 are actually passed as new laws. Remember, these are laws that have originated in closed-door meetings between corporate heads and legislators. Thursday, March 1st. After a meeting with Occupy Austin, the Austin City Council unanimously voted to explore options to divest its money from Bank of America and move it to a locally owned bank or credit union. Well done, occupiers. MERS ruling. Late last week, homeowners had a huge win when United States bankruptcy judge Robert Grossman ruled that MERS business practices are illegal. Judge Grossman explicitly acknowledged that this ruling sets a precedent with far-reaching consequences, as half of all mortgages in this country are processed through MERS. In his ruling, Judge Grossman labeled MERS positions as, quote, stunningly inconsistent with the facts, absurd at best, and not supported by the law. If you or someone you know is in danger of foreclosure, advise them to check with their bank to see if MERS was the handler. There's a 50% chance the mortgage was handled using illegal practices. Saturday, March 3rd, The Illuminator. This weekend, we saw the debut of Occupy's latest weapon in the quest to engage, educate, and inspire the masses. The Illuminator has hit the streets, a mobile cinema and library designed by the same gents who brought us the Bat Signal on N17. While this van will be touring occupations and public spaces across the country, yet another mobile work of art and activism, The Changemaker, will launch its voyage by May 1st. Mark these dates on your calendar for big events coming up. March 15th, Global March Against the Syrian Dictator. March 17th, our six-month anniversary, sure to be a big day at all occupations. And on April 28th, a National Action for Women's Reproductive Rights. And that's it for Radio WS Actual News.
They say, why we must occupy. Open up your eyes and just all look to the sky. And they say, this is just a movement, a new revolution. That's just how we do it. We're not gonna give up or ever stop. No, we gonna let it pop to the next generation. 2012. They say, why we must occupy. And they say, why occupy. And they say, why we occupy. We gotta get up, stand up for your rights, yeah. And they say,
okay, if you hide money you took out of the American economy overseas, you're not a patriot. There, I said it. I'm tired of rich people who have enjoyed 10 years of the Bush tax cuts for the rich telling me that poor people don't pay their fair share in taxes. They say that middle and low income Americans don't have enough skin in the game, while the banksters have skinned us alive. I'm tired of the richest of the rich demanding every break, and yet refusing to give a break to the other 99% of us. We don't even want a break. We want fair treatment and a chance to work hard and prosper. But that can't happen when we're exploited and the chips are stacked against us. And frankly, I'm sick of whiny rich people who keep saying that we aren't working hard enough. They sound like slave drivers. I'm sick of being told we all have to sacrifice when the richest among us aren't willing to sacrifice a damn thing. Think of the anti-tax zealots who go into convulsions when we mention raising taxes on the rich. These clowns also think it's fine and fair to make poor middle-income people pay more taxes so they will have more skin in the game. They want to have their cake and eat yours too. Poor people don't have a Cayman Islands to put their money into. They don't even have money. Many of these poor people only recently became poor after being unemployed in this jobless bankster's paradise, and many other currently poor people used to have good paying jobs that they worked hard at every day until the union busters and job outsourcers and right-to-work shills destroyed many of the good jobs we used to have in America and turned them into low-paying mick jobs at poverty wages with no benefits. Union busters want to blame you for your own poverty, even though they created the conditions for that poverty to exist. To hell with that. Income inequality is a disaster in America. The growing impoverishment of the working class is hurting the economy far more than any regulation big business would love to strip down. Yet the rich and those who consume their propaganda have built a tower of Babel around the notion that poor people are bad, lazy, criminally inclined leeches on society who gain the entire system to their own benefit, and we couldn't live without our benevolent job-creating fat cats. Karl Rove would be proud. In reality, it's the other way around. You couldn't eat without a working farmer feeding you. You couldn't drive without a construction worker paving your roads. And you wouldn't be able to read this without a hardworking teacher who taught you how to read. Those people are the job creators. The rich son of a self-made businessman who makes an income based off of stock bets he made is the idle rich. He doesn't work, he lives off of other people's work, and he should be damned grateful for it. I don't even mind that he's wealthy where he is. It is when he starts shipping my job overseas that I get mad. It's when he starts shutting down businesses in America so he can make a bigger CEO salary that I get mad. And when he tells me I have to fight in his wards and pay more in taxes while he hides his money in the Cayman Islands, he shouldn't be surprised when I start thinking of pitchforks and torches. The long and short of it is this. It's a disgusting outrage that the people who made wealth in America we all work together to build can hide that wealth in the Cayman Islands to avoid taxes while demanding that the poor and working class pay more. So here's a new rule. You're not a patriot if you hide money you made in America in the Cayman Islands to avoid taxes. And you're not allowed to call yourself a patriot again until you put your money where your mouth is and take it out of the Cayman Islands and bring it all back to America where it came from. Rant off.
Time now for Bob Babb's Bobby and Barb, brought to you by Mozilla Goldman and Fuld. On food stamps, we have a mortgage for you. Say, Bob, why the long face?
I don't know. Lately, my face feels, well, bland.
Yeah, I see what you mean, Bob. Been getting out much?
Well, not really. Unlike you, I have a job.
Touche. But my face feels exciting, new, refreshed.
What's your secret?
It's all natural spicy pepper, Bob.
Really? Is that all?
That's it. And what's more, it's free.
Come on down with us, Bob, and occupy some Wall Street.
It'll freshen up your face fast, real fast, with pepper. Real pepper sprayed right from a can.
Get a buzz from the fuzz.
It's a pisser for your kisser.
Join us next time for Bob Babb's Bobby and Barb, brought to you by Mozilla, Goldman, and Fuld, redefining the American dream, one job at a time.
They are all standing in solidarity.
And they are all standing in solidarity.
To protect somebody's house.
To protect somebody's house.
In their community.
In their community.
One of the most important parts of a reform agenda is to encourage people to own something, own their own home. Government must stand on the side of people. Because I understand if you own something, you have a vital stake.
I heard my dad saying we might lose our home.
My home.
3 million families now are said to be in danger of foreclosure. That's a 50-state Katrina.
The cascading impact of the subprime mess is clear. No mortgage relief plan can undo the loose practices of the real estate bubble.
What goes up must come down. What goes up must come down. What goes up must come down. And that holds true. Foreclosures have skyrocketed.
Not because they've lost their jobs. Not because of life circumstances. But because the mortgage is pushing them into foreclosure.
The meltdown of the subprime mortgage market, how can I make this work for me?
They all displace themselves in our communities and rip people off.
I'm George W. Bush, and I approve this.
We lose this house. We lose everything. It's all we've got.
People being taken advantage of, losing the American dream.
It's designed for you to lose your home.
My home.
Your home.
Watch out. Watch out. Watch out.
The people who've been victimized by the subprime scam have not been covered. The media has responsibility for this. You know why? Because media outlets were taking ads from these mortgage lenders. They're taking ads from these credit card companies. They're making money on getting people into debt.
Where are the investigations?
Hey, hello everybody. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector. 14 million people are in the category of either in or facing foreclosure in America. That's a catastrophe. These policies were quite intentional. They knew exactly what they were doing. This wasn't done, as a result of errors. It was a plan. And it was a plan that many industries worked together on. That's what most people don't know to this day, that the insurance industry is represented by AIG, which insured the big banks, the finance industry, of course, that invested in all of this, and also the real estate firms that went out and peddled these homes to try to attract and seduce people into buying homes they knew they couldn't afford. 14 million people are in the category of either in or facing foreclosure in America. That's a catastrophe. You know, what's ironic about all of this is that Wall Street today is one of the most highly secure area. They have surveillance cameras looking at every single person on the street. The Occupy Wall Street, they had a whole truck there, a whole unit that was filming 24 hours a day, every single person with cameras that could zoom in on them, actually even hear what they were saying. And that's what they did on Wall Street. Ironically, there were no cameras on the inside documenting what they were talking about and what they were doing. In other words, they're planning, they're scheming to create this crisis to benefit themselves and to cost the rest of us our whole economy. I'm very pleased to have in the studio with me Ray Lewis, a former captain of the Philadelphia Police Department, who showed up at Occupy Wall Street with his uniform and supported the occupation. And for his troubles and for his courage and his stand, he was denounced by some of the executives of the Philadelphia Police Department and arrested by the NYPD. And he's here to tell the tale. He's been very visible in standing up for the principles that he believes in.
Well, you're listening to the new Radio OWS, Polarity One, and the team, Goldie and the others from the work group that actually created this radio show. It's going to be a weekly program, and you've heard it here on Progressive Radio Network. Hopefully, other editions of this series will be heard. I was happy to contribute to it. So we're going to be back to talk a little bit about Russia in a minute or two.
Nothing to show. I'm all night, can't sleep right. My head's tight. Got my food, clothes, books, and it looks like there's holes in my shoes. What to do? My credit card's full, and it's due. No job, no time, no reason, no rhyme. Gotta get it together before I'm a mess. Walk the line between ruin and success. That's no joke.
Okay, we're going to move now to talking about what's happening in Russia, which is a fascinating situation. Here's just a little anecdote before I introduce our next guest, David Kotz. On Sunday, the people of Russia voted, and over 63% of the popular vote went to, guess who, Vladimir Putin. Voting precinct 451, based in the Chechen capital of Grozny. Of the 1,389 voters registered there, an amazing 1,482 voted in favor of the former KGB surveillance agent. Grozny boasted a 106 voter support race in a place where Putin waged war not once, but twice. Does this surprise you, David Kotz, a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, co-author of Russia's Path from Gorbachev to Putin, The Demise of the Soviet System and the New Russia? What's your thought?
No, it is not surprising. Elections in Russia have been increasingly dishonest and fixed over the period since the end of the Soviet Union in 1991. Although the curious thing this time is that most observers believe that Vladimir Putin would have gotten over 50% of the vote even if they had not fixed the vote.
Yeah, but also there's something new happening there, which is really interesting to me, which is the emergence of so much protest against Putin. We haven't seen that before, including, you know, people talking about Occupy the Kremlin movement. I mean, it seems as if there is a resistance growing in Russia. What is this resistance? Who are they? Why are they opposing Putin?
Well, Russia is part of the world, and there is a protest mood in the world at this time, and it has affected Russia. There had been various kinds of protests in Russia previously, but they were quickly repressed. Groups couldn't hold open protests, ranging from liberal to left-wing. They would just be repressed. And after the parliamentary elections in December, the regime was taken by surprise when tens of thousands of demonstrators showed up, a much larger number than had appeared before. And I think that was affected by the mood and by outrage over the fixing of the parliamentary elections, which used to be a little bit more fairly counted. It had been the presidential election that the regime had concentrated on fixing. And I think the authorities weren't sure what to do. And before they knew it, they had 100,000 people in Moscow, and it's a little difficult to repress a demonstration of 100,000 people without a lot of bloodshed. So they let it go on for a few weeks. The demonstrators seem to be pretty diverse, but the media have emphasized that many middle-class, well-off people have participated in the demonstrations. They're angry both about the fixing of the parliamentary elections and about Putin's decision that he was going to run and become the next president for another 6 years.
Now, tell us about Putin himself. I mean, what don't we know about this man? Who exactly is he? How did he emerge as out of the ranks of the KGB to become the president of Russia?
Well, here's the background story. He was an obscure figure, but he worked in the part of the presidential administration under the previous president, Boris Yeltsin, that managed all the properties owned by the Kremlin. This was considered the center of corruption in Russia. And he was the second in command of the Kremlin Property Management Office. Yeltsin was looking for someone who would not turn against him and charge him with corruption after he left office. And Putin himself had worked in this corrupt office, and Yeltsin probably had a big dossier on him. So that made Putin seem safe. I'm sure there was some deal made because Putin was Yeltsin's chosen successor. He was elected president in 2000 to follow Yeltsin, and he immediately passed a decree that stated that Yeltsin and his family members could not even be investigated, much less prosecuted. So that's, you know, that's how he came to be president. He was seen as safe by Yeltsin. Then he turned out to be very strongly authoritarian, a much more organized person than Yeltsin, who had been an alcoholic and unpredictable. And Russia has followed, however, the same path that occurred under Yeltsin, which was one that began with the relatively democratic institutions that emerged at the end of the Soviet era under Gorbachev, when they actually held free elections, to an increasingly authoritarian regime.
Now, he's a martial artist. He likes to go around showing off his muscles. He seems to, be a bit of a contradiction. On the one hand, a strong, almost nationalistic leader of Russia, critical of the United States on many fronts, upsetting the United States by refusal to play along with American policy, vetoing, the recent UN measure Syria. At the same time, he seems, also crusading against other oligarchs in Russia selectively.
Very selectively. I mean, I think the best way to understand the Putin regime, it is the top oligarch. Putin and his circle have become extremely rich, and a non-governmental oligarch who will follow the leadership of Putin and not challenge him in any way is free to operate and siphon funds from the raw materials and metals sectors of the Russian economy. Those oligarchs who have in any way challenged Putin, such as Mikhail Khodorkovsky, end up either in prison or fleeing the country. A regime like this, a socioeconomic system like the one that arose in Russia after the Soviet period, in which a small number of people, most of them insiders, some of them from organized criminal backgrounds, ended up seizing all the most valuable assets of Russia, of post-Soviet Russia, such a socioeconomic system cannot coexist with democracy. This newfound wealth had no legitimacy in Russia, and if there had been real democracy, in fact, in 1996, the communist candidate Zhuganov would have become president. He actually did win the presidential election, but it was stolen. So they need to have oligarchy there, and I must say the similarities, although less extreme, to the way things have developed in our country are...
Yeah, I was going to raise that. As I heard you describing about this oligarchy, this elite, basically transferring wealth to itself, seizing the financial levers of power, the political levers of power, I kept thinking, he's talking about Wall Street. We have become... the very thing we were criticizing in terms of the oligarchy in Russia. Our system seems to resemble that more and more every day.
Well, there was an old story that in the Soviet days, when the Communist Party ruled in the Soviet Union, that American communists used to say, if we look at Soviet Russia, we see America's future. Well, I'm afraid now, if we look at post-Soviet Russia, I worry that we see America's future, because just as Russia followed the most extreme neoliberal free market restructuring after 1991, a somewhat less extreme version of free market restructuring of our society has occurred in the U.S. And so
they were Americans. Let's not forget there were Americans who played a big role in helping that, quote, restructuring of the Soviet system to a, quote, free market economy. This was done with substantial help from a lot of financiers and a lot of people who were, in a way, profiting off of this.
Well, that's right. The U.S. Treasury Department, the IMF, the World Bank all insisted that Russia follow what was then called shock therapy, what today we would call rapid neoliberal transformation. But I think it's important to emphasize that the people who came to power in post-Soviet Russia needed no persuading. They saw neoliberal transformation as a way for themselves and their friends to freely get control and ownership of the most valuable asset. So it was a meeting of minds.
In other words,
we're seeing a similar thing happening now in the U.S. with decades now of privatization and the government deregulation of business, that a new oligarchy has arisen here. And from the financial sector, they're enormously rich, and we see them dominating the elections.
David, just on this one point, I know you have to run, so I promise not to keep you too long. But, it seems to me that these issues are fascinating. They're important, but I don't think they're really coming through very clearly in our media.
Well, I think there is a growing awareness that the 1% have too much riches and too much power. I think they're, at least among the ordinary people, there's a growing awareness of this, and hopefully the Occupy movement will grow and create the possibility of actually doing something about it.
Well, listen, David Kotz, thank you so much for joining me here at the last moment. I know you have other things to do. You're the co-author of Russia's Path from Gorbachev to Putin, The Demise of the Soviet System and the New Russia. And the book explains how the U.S. backed many of the policies that led to the autocratic rise of Vladimir Putin. So this wasn't just Putin acting alone. There was more to it. So thanks a lot for coming on today to help us understand it. This is one of the things we try to do on the program, is to analyze what's in the news with voices and perspectives and people who often don't get on the air or often have a lot more to say than what we're being told. And David Kotz is one of those people. Another one is Boris Kagarlitsky. He's actually a Russian. He's the director of the Institute for Globalization and Social Movements in Moscow. His books include Restoration in Russia, Why Capitalism Failed, An Empire of the Periphery, Russia and the World System. He was arrested under Brezhnev and under Yeltsin for his political activism. He was recently interviewed. He's going to come on the program. I've been in touch with him. I had hoped to have him on live, but he's traveling in Moldavia today. So he couldn't make it, but said he'd like to come on in the future. In the interim, he writes for ZNet, which is an outlet that I also write for, and he was interviewed recently by Real News, talking about this election in Russia. Let's hear from a Russian.
Welcome to the Real News Network. I'm Paul Jay. And in Russia, the presidential elections are now over. There are still votes to be counted, but it's rather clear. Vladimir Putin will be the next president of Russia. He apparently has garnered more than 60% of the popular vote in what Vladimir Putin said is one of the fairest, most transparent elections in the history of Russia. Now, he's not the only one saying that. If you're watching RT at all today, most of the pundits and analysts and reporters on RT are saying the same thing. And there's been a lot of talk about something new, which was webcams in all of the polling stations. Here's a report from RT.
We won't forget and we won't forgive. This is what the opposition promised the Kremlin after December's parliamentary elections. They claimed the vote had been rigged. In response, the authorities decided web cameras at all 98,000 polling stations would solve that problem. It's cost Russian taxpayers over $300 million, doubling the initial cost of the vote. Now it's officially the most transparent and the most expensive in the nation's history.
Now joining us from Moscow to unpack the Russian elections is Boris Kagarlitsky. Boris is a sociologist. He's an advisor to the chairperson of the Federation of Independent Trade Unions of Russia, and he's the director of the Institute of Globalization and Social Movements. Thanks for joining us, Boris.
Hello.
So what do you make of these transparent elections and this webcam technology? And then we'll get more into the substance of what was at stake.
And there was a kind of funny scandal because one polling station in Dagestan was shown on a webcam where we saw two guys who carried piles of ballots. And they were electronic ballot boxes, so they kept pushing through these electronic ballot boxes, one ballot after another, time and again, and that was already on air. Then people got it, and they connected that to the internet, so the whole country enjoyed the show, watched them just pushing in ballots in piles, and then they ran out of ballots, and some other guy came and brought in more ballots to get into the ballot box and so on. And of course, the numbers of irregularities in the electoral process, these numbers are quite astonishing, even compared to the previous elections, even compared to what happened in December. But I think the main problem is not there. The main problem is that electoral rules are completely unfair and undemocratic because it's the government itself, the administration itself, which selects who is going to run, who are going to be the opponents of Putin. So in that sense, it's a kind of joke, the selection. If you have anyone who is not part of the ruling elite, not part of the system, he's not going to be allowed to get any close to the ballot box, to the ballot.
And the point here is that it's hard to register parties, and there's all kinds of technicalities that can be used to prevent candidates from getting on the ballot.
Registering a new party in Russia is impossible. Since they've got a new law on registering party, not a single party managed to be registered. And the law is created in such a way that it is simply not possible to register anybody. But at the same time, the government or the Ministry of Justice is allowed to deregister any party almost at any moment with lots and lots of pretexts, some of which are just very funny. So in that sense, all the existing parties, they are totally under control.
Now, is there any doubt in your mind that Putin probably did pass the 50% barrier?
No, he didn't. I'm sure he didn't. That's very clear. I think the real score was, basically the same as the official score of United Russia in December, which was also highly inflated. So I think the real score of Putin was much higher than the real score of United Russia, which is about the official score of United Russia. So I think he was at the level of maybe 49%, maybe 50% even, but not anything close to 60 as they announced. And the level of fraud was quite falling.
So
that's an interview with the Russian analyst Boris Kargalitsky, who is actually suggesting that Putin did not. This is certainly a belief that many hold in Russia. At the same time, you know, Putin is a force who, to some degree, seems to be checking America's imperial ambitions around the world. And you know, that's an interesting also. Pepe Escobar of Asia Times, who's one of the best financial analysts out there, has a piece about all of this. And, you know, he says that Washington and its minions have been warned. Before last Sunday's election, Putin even advertised his roadmap. The essentials: no war on Syria, no war on Iran, no humanitarian bombing or fomenting color revolutions, all bundled into a new concept, illegal instruments of soft power. For Putin, the Washington-engineered New World Order is a no-go. When Putin looks at Libya, he sees the graphic, repressive consequences of NATO's, quote, liberation through humanitarian bombing. More key essentials of his roadmap: no U.S. bases encircling Russia, no U.S. missile defense without strict admission in writing that the system will never target Russia, and increasingly close cooperation among the BRICS group of emerging countries. So here we have Putin, you know, clearly authoritarian, clearly self-dealing, clearly involved in a very corrupt kleptocracy, oligarch nation that has really diverted the wealth of many people in Russia to their own, you know, banks in Switzerland and elsewhere. So there's this negative side to it. But on the positive side to it, at least as far as I'm concerned, because you want to have checks and balances in the world. You don't want Washington or Israel to be able to unilaterally determine what happens in the world according to their own interests. In my opinion, I don't think that's very healthy or in the interests of either Israel or the United States. So Putin, in some ways, you know, is like, you know, the cop holding up the no-go sign, you know, at a crowded intersection. And he's basically a pain in the butt for the United States. China also occasionally plays this role. So there is some restraint on American power. So Putin, for all of the ways in which he outrages the ideas of democracy and Russia, Russian people, in terms of stealing their wealth, he also seems to be a force to check American imperial ambitions in the world. And that's why he is upsetting, or in the words of Pepe Escobar, driving Washington nuts. So Putin is this phenomenon which has to be, you know, has to be examined. Would we do better with an American stooge in the place of Putin in Russia? What would that mean? Where would the wealth be going then? You know, we have the whole period of the demise of the Soviet Union where Western powers, you know, basically put their greedy little hands into the money pots in Russia and diverted a lot of that to themselves. This is something that's been discussed widely, the so-called shock therapy period, you know, in Russia, which was, you know, basically shocking to the Russians, but profitable to the people who were involved in doing it. So, you know, we can't simply draw, you know, a black and white moral equation here. Yes, people should have democracy, democratic rights, and freedom. I'm all for that. But also, there has to be freedom here in the United States to dissent, to challenge American power, to try to stand up against war, militarism, you know, and the theft of American money, you know, from the pockets of the middle class into the pockets of the 1%. And these are the issues that really, really need for us to really, parse, suss out, sort out, discuss, debate, and all the rest of it. This is what we're trying to do to some degree on this radio program every week, is to raise issues that aren't being raised in the mainstream or lamestream media. And we'll be doing more of that. Kat has some things to add to the discussion. I'll go to her in a second. I just want to, while I still have your attention, hopefully, to basically invite you to write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. The actual podcast of this program will be on the PRN.FM website later today. I'll also have it in my newsdissector.net blog. So, yes, indeed, you'll be able to see it. If you have any interest in helping with our work, our media work on News Dissector or TV programming and this radio show, please write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. We do need some help here, some volunteer help. Alas, we don't have the funds to do it. We're not getting paid anything to do this show, but we do think it's important. One of the things I actually Kat pioneered this week or did this week was a new website. You want to start off by telling us about that?
We just invite everyone to check out Dan's new Facebook page. It's under Book Danny Schechter for a Lecture. If anyone, any institution, schools, churches are interested in having Danny come and speak, or we can show he's got a new short documentary on the Occupy movement with a book that will be out along with it soon, or the latest documentary on the Wall Street scandal called Plunder, the Crime of Our Time. But I also just wanted to read a short paragraph along the lines of the media, the lamestream media that we were just talking about under the new title magazine from Occupy Wall Street. It's called Mainstream Media is No Different Than the Banks. The media is one of the most effective tools protecting market interests and shaping public opinion, and as such should be thought of no differently than concentrations of power on Wall Street or Capitol Hill. So why, in this one area, do we continue to play by their rules? At what point does an attempt to work within a corrupt system begin to replicate the system we seek to destroy?
Well, provocative ideas, important ideas that certainly aren't raised in the media but are raised here on News Dissector Radio every week at this time on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, PRN.FM. There is an event tonight we want to tell you about quickly because we have to move on here.
Okay, this evening, Repression and Resistance, From the Panthers to OWS. It's going to be this evening at Judson Memorial Church, 55 Washington Square South. It begins at 5 o'clock. There's three parts. From 5 p.m. to 6, anti-repression, know your rights training. Protect yourself, your family, community, know your rights, how to avoid risks, know how to respond when your rights are being violated. At 6 p.m., there's a dinner and a screening of COINTELPRO.
COINTELPRO, which was the repressive effort that the FBI made to infiltrate and divide the movement. We see this week, infiltration in the hacking community, the arrest of the leader of a hacking group who then actually turned in and ratted out some of his colleagues. So that was in the news this week. We're going to see more of that tactic, I'm sure. Thanks again for being with us. We're leaving you now here on PRN-FM. Danny Schechter, your news dissector. Until next week.
Down your guard. We'll send you a gift to give you a lift, a shiny new credit card.